So I would be concerned in my talk with the modeling of the star formation and dust absorption in local galaxies. And the main difference, of course, of the star-forming galaxies with respect to elliptical galaxies is that they contain dust, gas. And therefore, to interpret the spectral properties of star-forming galaxies, one needs models not only to compute the production of starlight by maybe I should sit on this side here, I think. So one needs not only to compute the production of the starlight by the stars within the galaxies, but also to follow the absorption of the light by gas and dust within the ISM of the galaxies. And that one. So, and this involves different types of modeling studies. And the first thing is that one has to have a stellar population synthesis models to compute the emission from stellar populations, evolving stellar populations, as a function of star formation history. And second, one needs to have a model that computes the nebula emission from gas that is photonized by the stars within the galaxies. And finally, one needs another kind of model to compute the transfer of the non-ionizing ionizing stellar radiation through the ISM of the galaxies. And in practice, models for the photoionization of the gas and for the transfer of stellar radiation within the ISM of galaxies have not been or rarely combined with population synthesis models. And the main reason for this is probably that this type of models requires a large number of free parameters that are not always specified in simple galaxy evolution models. At the same time, the observations of local galaxies exhibit well-defined relations, for example, in line ratio relations, also in a relation between the ultraviolet versus far continuum, far infrared continuum. And therefore, it is legitimate to ask whether one can come up with some kind of relatively simple model to account for these relations and also to be able to study the scatter around them. And for these types of questions, it is useful to note one property of dust within the ISM of the galaxies, which is that dust within the H2 regions may affect the absolute luminosity of the hydrogen recombination lines, but not the relative ratios with respect to the dust free case B recombination. Therefore, for galaxies for which one has at least two hydrogen recombination lines, one can at least correct for the absorption that happens outside of the H2 region, and then be concerned with interpreting the line emission from the H2 regions as a function of star formation rate. So, for this reason, I'll actually divide the rest of my talk into parts. One part in which I will be concerned into interpreting line emission from galaxies as star formation rates, and then another part in which I will discuss the absorption of starlight by dust in the ISM of the galaxies. So first, star formation rate from nebula emission lines. And in searching the literature for models that allow to interpret emission line fluxes in terms of star formation rate, one encounters basically three types of studies. And the first type is just pure photoionization models that people develop to interpret the physical parameters of H2 regions as a function of emission lines ratios. And and parameters to be determined, ionization parameters, the abundances, the temperature density, and also there's a very nice study of the effects of dust within H2 regions by Fields and Watkins. So the studies have provided great insight into the parameters that are driving the observer relations. And here I show examples of observer relations that have been used to constrain the H2 regions parameters. Here I'm showing the oxygen 3 over H beta ratio as a function of O2 or 3, nitrogen 2 over H alpha, and sulfur 2 over H alpha. And this is for H2 regions in blue and galaxies in black here. And one of the results that these these photoionization models have shown is that these sequences are largely driven by sequences in ionization parameters of the H2 regions and also of metallicity. So I refer you to the papers for more details about this. Now, another type of models that were developed, more in the spirit of determining star formation rates from emission lines, consisted in mixing population synthesis models in order to get the information about the ionization radiation from the stars with simple prescriptions for the line emission. And in some cases, the prescription consists simply in using case B plus 3, case B recombination to get the H alpha luminosity as a function of the ionizing photons. And in other cases, it was more refined and interpolating the results from detailed photoionization models to get an estimate of the flux in the O2 and O3 lines. And finally, the most recent and complex studies of emission lines from stellar populations consist in mixing population synthesis models with actual full photoionization models, and mostly in the spirit of studying the ages and metallicity of giant extragalactic extra regions. Now, these diagrams here, where both the H2 regions and galaxies are shown, show that the galaxies more or less follow the sequence of H2 regions, except that there seems to be some offset in diagrams involving the nitrogen 2 and sulfur 2 lines. And this difference is generally interpreted as a sign of evidence for the contribution by diffuse ionized gas in the galaxies to the total line emission. In fact, there is an agreement from different studies that about 20 to 50% of the line emission is accounted for by diffuse ionized gas. And this, the gas is consistent with being mostly photoionized by the stars, mostly. That's a small contribution by shock. And it's characterized by a lower ionization parameter at fixed metallicity. So in estimating the star formation rate from the Balmer line emission from galaxies, for example, one has to include also this contribution. There have been relatively few discussions of the conversion factors between line emission and star formation rate in galaxies, and the most widely used calibrations are those of the H alpha and the oxygen 2 lines, the H alpha essentially from the 3 case B recombination, and for a few samples, the efficiency factor for the oxygen 2 line has been estimated by taking the mean of the O2 over H alpha effectively ratio over the samples and scaling with the efficiency at the H alpha line. So the most widely used calibration are those from Rob Kennicott, actually, for the H alpha efficiency factor, and there are two slightly different calibrations of the O2 emission line as a function of star formation rate from two slightly different samples, Gallagher and from Rob also in 92. So it is also widely recognized that these calibrations depend very strongly on the initial mass function, but there is little to be done, at least from the point of view of the emission lines alone, and then therefore the only thing which is usually done is just to calibrate all of these on the same EIM. Now, observed galaxies show a range of about an order of magnitude in the ratio of O2 over H alpha, and therefore at fixed efficiency parameter for the H alpha line, there should be also a range of factor of about 10 for the efficiency production of oxygen 2 line. And using scaling formulae similar to this one plus the observed relation, effectively this relation here, shown by the red line, one can actually get a guess of the scaling of the efficiency parameters as a function of various line ratios in the galaxies. And this is what is shown in this diagram here in the case of the O2 over H beta line. So these four panels show the efficiency parameter for the H alpha line, H beta, O2, and O3. And under the rough assumption that the H alpha conversion factor is fixed, H beta scales just for a case B recombination, as I explained before. And this panel here raises the interesting point that these kind of diagrams may be useful to refine the values of star formation estimators in galaxies by looking at their value as a function of the other line ratios. And in particular, if taken as a whole, the dispersion in the estimator of the O2 emission line would be a factor of 10, but if you look at it as a function of, in this case, the O2 over H beta ratio, then you can get more precise information. And the point is, of course, to estimate what the reliability of these relations is, and also what the dispersion around them is. So that's what we have done with a postdoc, Marcella Longhetti at the IAP. And what we did basically is estimate the mean and dispersion of these relations of the efficiency parameters of various lines as a function of various line ratios. And the way we did this is by combining population synthesis and photoionization models. Now, what we did is explore a comprehensive range of model parameters, all the parameters that could vary in a consistent way about the properties of the stars in terms of stellar metallicity, formation history, and the age, and also properties of the gas with the standard parameters for photoionization models, and in such a way that we would be consistent with the observed line ratios and the dispersion around the mean relations, and the lines we've considered are the shown here. So that includes the nitrogen 2 and sulfur 2 lines. And an example on how this allows us to assess the mean and the dispersion around these relations is shown by this diagram. And that's the same figure as before as a function of O2 over H beta here, but I overplotted the models on top of the semi-empirical relation. So I will refer you to our study for the details about the models. The only thing I'll mention is that the different symbols correspond to different metallicities of the gas and stars. And the two points I want to make is that you can see that even the H alpha conversion factor has a scatter of about a factor of 2 to 3, and which is due for the most part for the fact that as you decrease the metallicity of the stars, there's more ionizing flux produced because low metallicity stars evolve at hotter temperatures and larger luminosities, and also because of the potential presence of dust within the H2 regions. Here, the calculations confirm scaling a factor of 2.86 KSB recombination ratio for the H alpha versus H beta luminosities. And here, this diagram shows that at fixed O2 over H beta ratio, the dispersion, the conversion factor, is actually not larger than the one of the H alpha line. So, potentially, if one has precise information about the O2 over H beta ratio in the galaxies and get an estimate from the O2 line of the star formation rate and the H beta, I guess, or the O2 line, which is it's the same dispersion as the H alpha luminosity. So the goal, I mean, I plot the results as a function of O2 over H beta on this diagram because that is how the other empirical determinations were derived in the earlier plot. But what we find is that you can actually, depending on the available spectral information, you can get optimize the star formation estimator as a function of what you have. And sometimes the O3 emission line is actually quite good star formation indicator, for example. Now, if there is no way to get a handle on the absorption outside of the ionized gas in the galaxies, for example, by lack of hydrogen recombination lines, then one requires a full model for the transfer of radiation through the ISM. And the goal of such models is basically to relate the luminosity that you're seeing from the galaxy to the unattenuated stellar luminosity, and this can be written most simply as the Stiegel formula here. Now, the tau lambda hat in this formula is the effective absorption curve of the dust. And this will be different in general from the true absorption curve of the dust, since the scattering of the photons in the interstellar medium of the galaxies can actually change their path length before they are absorbed by dust. So the goal of weighted transfer models, therefore, is to determine how this effective absorption curve depends on the optical properties and the spatial distribution of the dust. And I mentioned that Daniele Calzelli et al. Proposed an empirical derivation of the effective absorption curve from a sample of nearby starburst, ultraviolet selected starburst galaxies, in which they basically assumed that the unattenuated stellar luminosity was given by the galaxies with the smallest H alpha over H beta ratio in the sample. Now, there have been different kinds of models for the absorption of starlight by dust developed. These have ranged from models of absorbing and scattering slabs that were developed to interpret the attenuation of radiation from extended sources like H2 regions, to models of radiative transfer for full galaxies to study the surface brightness of the galaxies, and also, most recently, very sophisticated models in which one mixes population synthesis plus radiative transfer consistently with the chemical evolution and galaxy formation models. And these are aimed at studying the properties of whole samples of galaxies in a consistent way. The one at least important result from these studies is that the effective absorption curve that appears in this equation up there can be very different from the true absorption curve or even from any non-extinction curve of the dust. And the reason for this, as was mentioned this morning, is that the emergent spectrum from the galaxies is weighted by the least extinct stars, basically it's dominated by the least obscured regions. There has been good progress also observationally to help the models, as now a wide range of spectral properties has been assembled for homogeneous samples of nearby galaxies, in particular a sample of nearby UV-selected starburst galaxies. The data were compiled by Mara et al. From different sources. And these observations are a challenge for the models in the sense that they can help to test whether the models can account for all of the effects of dust on the biospectral properties of the galaxies in a consistent way. So one of these observational constraints is a correlation between the ratio of the infrared total integrated bolometric dust luminosities to the UV luminosity at 1600 angstroms as a function of the UV spectral slope defined here as a power log fit between 1300 and 2600 angstroms. So this is correlation, a strong correlation. You can see the scatter appears to be real. This is a typical measurement error. And it is understood in the sense that UV photons are the ones that contribute most to the heating of the dust in the galaxies. Mara et al. Have calibrated, in fact, the attenuation of 1600 angstroms as a function of the slope, ultraviolet slope here in the galaxies. Witt and Gordon argued that this calibration is very uncertain by a factor of 10 or more, and recommend to use the ratio of the infrared to UV luminosity as a better indicator for the attenuation. Another correlation that is constrained to the model is the that between the H alpha over H beta ratio and the ultraviolet spectral slope, and that's not surprising as both are indicators of absorption within the galaxies. The interesting fact, though, is that the attenuation estimated from the H alpha over H beta ratio is actually a factor of 2, roughly, larger than the one estimated from the ultraviolet spectral slope. And one interpretation of this result is that the ultraviolet bright stars and the ionized gas producing the emission lines are have different spatial distribution in the galaxy. And Daniele Calzetti proposes a simple formula to account for this effect and just say that the attenuation of the continuum in the V band is about 44% of that of the emission line. Now there are some difficulties when applying these simple recipes to interpret the observations. And the most recent example of that is that of Sullivan et al., who used effective absorption law derived empirically by Calzetti et al. And also the simple recipe of the scaling between line and continuum attenuation to interpret and compare the star formation rates estimated from the UV luminosity and the line emission from a sample of UV selected nearby spiral and irregular galaxies. And so this figure is taken from their paper, and what it shows is the log of the star formation rate estimated from the UV light to that estimate from the H-alpha luminosity. And when they apply the full burst correction, they find that there is an offset between the two methods, good agreement being represented by this dashed line here, in the sense that the star formation rate estimated from the UV light is systematically larger than the one estimated from the H-alpha light. So they go through all the systematics and find that they cannot come from the analysis method, and show that when they do not apply the attenuation to the UV light, but do, you know, keep the one for the H-alpha, and then you get slightly better agreement. They also have some problems in explaining the scatter and isolation, and they actually have to appeal to some complicated histories of star formation involving multiple bursts to get models that can actually scan this data. Now, the tempting interpretation, of course, is that both this, you know, the difference in these relations and the scatter in these diagrams may actually come from the fact that a slightly more refined description is required. And in fact, I mean, this contrast between sophisticated population synthesis analysis and the rather crude prescription for dust is really showing a need for a model that can be versatile enough to interpret dust on different spectral properties of the galaxies. Now, with Mike Fall, we've recently completed such a model to compute the effect set of dust on the various spectral properties of the galaxies, and that is based on the idealized prescription of the main features of the ISM. And what we do there is start from a simple but fairly conventional view of the ISM, in which the young star clusters in the galaxies are born in dense clouds, and that they ionize the interiors of the clouds in which they are born. The line photons that are produced in these H regions and the continuum photons from the young stars are absorbed in the same way by the dust in the outer H1 envelopes of the clouds and also the ambient ISM. In Hubble, both the H2 and H1 regions can have dust, and dust in the ISM can be distributed in various ways. Now, one key feature of our models is that the burst clouds are finite lifetimes, and therefore, for stars that live longer than the burst clouds, yet the radiation is attenuated only by the ambient ISM, and this feature is important as it allows the ultraviolet continuum to be less attenuated than the emission lines. Yes? Okay. The main adjustable parameters of our model are the lifetime of the burst clouds, the effective absorption curve in the burst clouds and the ambient ISM, also the fraction of the dust in the burst clouds that is in H2 and H1 regions, and also the effective age of the starburst. Now, variations in these model parameters will naturally produce variations in the effects of dust on the various spectral properties of the galaxies. And in fact, we find that each model parameter has a specific influence on the various integrated spectral properties that are available for this homogeneous sample of galaxies I was talking about before. And this allows us to use that sample to calibrate the parameters of our model. And we find that we can identify models that can account for the typical properties, the scatter, and also the trends seen in the data. and I'll refer you to our paper if you're interested in the details. The two results I will mention are that the finite lifetime of the burst cloud is a key ingredient in this model to resolve this apparent discrepancy between the attenuation of the line and continuum photons in the galaxies. And if we did not have that feature in the model, for example, it would be impossible to interpret galaxies with a large H alpha over H beta ratio at fairly intermediate ultraviolet slopes. So another interesting result is that the beta is the ultraviolet spectral slope. It's the determined as a power law phi to the spectrum in the ultraviolet. This is the ratio of infrared to ultraviolet luminosity, H alpha over H beta ratio, and also the H alpha equivalent width is available for the same galaxy here as a function of the ultraviolet spectral slope. So this relation up here actually constrains the wavelength dependence of the effective absorption, and the curves here are examples of how we can account with these models for all of the spectral properties simultaneously. Now, an interesting result also of our study is that the observed mean relations can be closely approximated by a very simple recipe, which is consists in using just an effective absorption curve as a simple power law of index minus 0.7 to attenuate the line and continuum radiation from the stellar population and just lower the normalization of the curve by a factor of typically 3 after 10 to 7 years to account for the dispersal of the burst cloud. And the curves on this diagram were actually computed with this simple formula here. Now, to explain the scatter in this relation, you actually have to go through the full models. But the model parameters, which are relatively few, allow you to scan all of this diagram here. So I will just conclude in saying that observations of these nearby samples of galaxies have allowed us to design models that are suitable to account for the mean relations, both of line ratios, and account for the scatter, and interpret that in terms of the star formation and dust absorption properties, and that these models may be useful to interpret the spectra of galaxies at this large distance. Thank you.
Yeah?
So we find that the Calzetti law is slightly grayer than our new prescription, but we also understand why. The fact is, in the method used by Daniela, for the dust-free spectrum, they actually use a bunch of galaxies here at the lower end of the relation that may be relatively but perhaps not completely dust-free, basically. So, and this leads to a slight difference in the shape of the relation. And what was the other question?
To Paul, how ultraviolet wavelengths will this be accurate?
Well, it's mostly accurate at all of the ultraviolet wavelengths because, the dust heating really is 80%. 80% wavelength lower than 3,000 angstroms, 90% 4,000 angstroms, basically. So that is mostly accurate at the ultraviolet wavelengths.
How about 1,500 angstroms?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's most accurate at, 1,600 angstroms. David?
Yeah. Use the O2 line for getting star formation.
No, yeah.
Since you seem to imply that you need to have H beta in order to calibrate it properly.
Yeah, no. That was an example only that I showed, actually. I haven't gone through. We can talk about this later. That was just an example of the method that we've used, basically. And you can do similar diagrams of functional O2 over O3, basically. In that case, you don't have the H beta absorption. That was just the reason why I showed the plot with the O2 over H beta He said, because that's the plot, you know, that the quantity that is used by Rob and by Gallagher, it has to calibrate their relation. So, but what we go for actually in our studies, you know, is optimizing as a function of the available information what staff information is. I mean, we find, for example, that O3, you know, would be a good indicator at some point. I can show you the plots afterwards. Yeah.
Carlos?
When you were talking about the inferred star formation rates from UV continuum and H alpha, you show that if you correct for dust in the UV and correct for the H alpha, then you find that if I remember your diagram correctly, that for bright galaxies, the corrected the UV actually underestimates the
That's
two star
right.
formation rate.
Yeah.
For faint galaxies, it has the opposite sign.
Yeah, exactly.
What's the reason for this?
Well, I guess, I mean, let's say, we have an interpreter. I mean, okay, there's, the point is that Sullivan et al. Used a single prescription for all their galaxies, basically, just single low absorption law, you know, and a single scaling of H alpha versus UV. And what this shows is that, you know, you actually need some model that helps you, you know, where you could actually see which are the parameters that are changing along this sequence. And that, you know, gives you perfect agreement between the two methods. So I don't know what the parameters are because I just discovered this paper a few days ago and I had time to, you know, to look at the... But what this shows is that there the prescription that they've used is inappropriate, I think, and that you need more insight into what could be causing the attenuation at the UV and the H-alpha wavelengths. And I guess the model that I presented will help you study this. It's just that the study hasn't been made yet.
And some of the effects are huge.
Exactly, yeah.